I didn't think that would be something I would enjoy, teaching songwriting. There was so much interest, and I enjoyed it so much. It made me realize how much I really love hearing the early embryonic forms of songs. There's something very exciting about even other people's creative process.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Rosemond, which I hope inspires you through the personal stories of a diversity of musicians with in-depth conversations and great music that reveal the depth and breadth to a life in music. Jean Rowe is an acclaimed songwriter and singer, as well as a devoted mentor, working with incarcerated songwriters as well as at the New School and privately. She writes powerful narrative songs and is widely known for her national anthem, Arise, Arise, an aspirational alternative, which has been performed extensively across the U.S. by choirs and many musicians. She shared with me her perspectives on love, grief, identity, community, and creativity. One of her beautiful collaborations is the wonderful album Butylina with the band Eureka Shoes, with Sky Soto Steele, Charlie Burnham, and Rashawn Carter. We're featuring music from that project, as well as with Robinson and Rowe. Like all my episodes, you can watch this on my YouTube or listen to the podcast on all the podcast platforms, and I've also linked the transcript to my website, leahrosemond.com. This weekly podcast is in Season 5, and I send out an email newsletter where you can get access to exclusive information about upcoming guests. Have a look at the description of this episode, where you'll find all the links, including detailed timestamps, and ways to support the series, for which I do all the many jobs myself. Hey, Jean, thanks so much for joining me here today.
Oh, my pleasure. Good to be here.
I absolutely love this album you have put together with Eureka Shoes, Butylina. So, first of all, the band name.
Everybody wants to know.
Have to ask.
Yeah. Well, the band name has a lot to do with the origins of this band as such. The band is Charlie Burnham, Sky Soto Steele, Rashawn Carter, and myself. And we started hanging out, Charlie and Sky and I. I mean, Sky and I are old friends. Charlie and Sky had a duo project for a long time, but sort of in the like early post-vaccination days here in Brooklyn, I was going over to Charlie's house and just playing songs I'd been writing and that Sky and Charlie had been writing together and hanging out. And at some point, that summer, Charlie had a recording residency that he was awarded at Looking Glass Arts in upstate New York. And we went up there and recorded with Rashawn a bunch of the songs that we'd been kicking around, and really had an amazing time working on that. Our band had a variety of names when we came back and started, playing some little shows around town, none of which lasted very long. And somehow Eureka Shoes is the one that floated to the top. I think we were sitting around in Charlie's kitchen talking about band names and, we were thinking about like the forces that had brought us together, one of whom is Marika Hughes, who is the curator and director of Looking Glass Arts. And I said something like, I think it was me. I said something like, "Oh, I think we have a lot to be grateful for, something that rhymes with Eureka Shoes." And so we have this band name that rhymes with our recording residency benefactors name.
Yeah. I was looking at their website this morning. It seems like a beautiful place, and they do wonderful things.
Incredible place. I really recommend it to any of your listeners who are artists or interested in music, which I'm sure if they're listening, they are. There's just so much fresh work coming out of that space every year that they're running residencies. And it's fairly new. It's maybe only a handful of years old, so I'm sure there's a lot more exciting stuff in the pipeline for that residency space.
So before we dive into your songwriting and the album, I thought I was interested to find out you had a family band growing up.
Oh yeah, I did. I grew up in a family that was really musical, but in a really, I don't know, I want to say like humble and non-professional way. Like it was a real revelation to me at some point in my childhood that like people I don't know, that there was some connection between what we were doing and, like, people on MTV. Like, it just felt like a whole other world. We would sing around the house. I mean, I don't want to paint too cheesy a picture of it, but it really was just, like, music was woven into our lives from a really young age. My mom is one of those harmony singers who just, like, intuits the sort of the most pleasing path at every moment. And my dad was a self-taught guitar player with, like, a wide appetite of interest. But when my brother and I were growing up, we spent a lot of time singing everything from, like, I don't know, like, Americana music and trad stuff from around the States, to, like, show tunes with my grandma. And, you know, my dad had a real love of jazz, and so that was woven in there. And yeah, at some point we started performing out just really locally in New Jersey, where I grew up. And I guess I just never really stopped. I mean, the music has evolved, and the family band really just convenes when we're hanging out together these days. But all of us are still making music, and I'm doing it professionally. I mean, my father has since passed away, but my brother is a teacher who, like, he's a history teacher, but he brings music into his class all the time. My mom's, like, life is infused with music in every realm. So I feel really fortunate in that way, that I grew up with a music in my life, and not some of the pressure that I, like, have noticed that some of my peers have come up with, whether it's because they were, like, taking violin lessons with a really strict teacher and had a very, like, narrow path in that regard, which has its beautiful pros and its cons, you know, or people who were really aspiring to some kind of, like, pop stardom greatness, and weren't getting a lot of, like, the satisfaction of just making music for whoever was around.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that actually brings me, I picked a few of the tracks I particularly loved on this album, but the whole thing's fantastic. Linked in the description. I encourage people to click on that. So, Go Easy.
Oh, yeah.
Which really reflects what you're talking about. Did you write that tune, or was it a co-write?
That was mine. And I was really glad to bring it to the group, because it felt kind of like a weird egg-shaped kind of song in some ways. There's just a lot of sort of metric shifting that came organically to it, and as I was writing, and it really wasn't until I tried to kind of jot it down for the band that I realized what was going on there. And Charlie and Sky just, like, brought, I don't know, so much texture and shape to it through their contributions. I guess I just, that's how I would say it. It was a real, let's see, I probably wrote that at the beginning of 2021. Yeah, just feeling the way that the kind of drastic shift in so many of our lives because of the pandemic was affecting the joy and well-being for many people around me, you know, and myself. Yeah, like so many of my songs, just lyrically, it's a reminder to me as much as anything else, you know. Go easy on yourself. Like, nobody else will probably do that for you. So it's so important to be kind. And yeah, it was just a really beautiful thing to share that with Charlie and Sky. Charlie's playing a mandola with a slide. And so there's this really beautiful texture that comes in there. And then some spare, but I think really powerful three-part harmony that happens in that song. Mm-hmm. I'm glad you like it.
This is Go Easy from the album Butylina with Eureka Shoes. Check the link in the show notes. Yourself.
So this pandemic summer 2021, you know, I've talked to many people. It's still, for me, it's still fresh. And I'm wondering, for you, did you think it wouldn't last so long, or were you, how did it affect you? Did it, you said you were creating, you're able to write.
Yeah. In fits and starts, though, I think, what can I say? That period of time felt like a real opening, like starting to play in the spring with Charlie and Sky, and to be at Looking Glass Arts and to be outside in the summer that year. I think so much of that era for me was really like weighted with anxiety and worry, and just like the practicalities of like caring for my households and like our well-being. You know, we lived in New York City, and the beginning stages of the pandemic were particularly rough here. Our like dear neighbor died a couple weeks in, right on our block, and it just felt very heavy. And I was doing I have to say, a lot of the writing that I did in that period of time was not great. I mean, I was writing songs, and like most of them haven't seen the light of day. You know, and then there were some like unrelated, like huge health emergencies in my family that really like brought me into a heavy caretaking role for a period of a few months. And I'm glad I was able to be around for that. But, and then of course, like, yes, who can forget the period of time in 2020 after George Floyd's murder, and this sudden kind of like arousal and being in the street, which was also, you know, hugely resonant in my physical reality in New York City too. And so I know some people find their most creatively fertile moments in the times of greatest like distress or anguish or sorrow. And I think what I've noticed about myself is that I can reflect on those moments, but I need a little bit more space for some kind of meaning to take shape about what's happening. Mm-hmm. Music is always there for me to lean on, thank goodness. But in those moments of deepest anguish, it's helpful to like sing things that I feel like I know, rather than trying to find something brand new and investigate. It's just something I've observed about myself. Mm-hmm. So it felt amazing to get together in the spring in 2021 and say, like, here are like a handful of things that have come from this period that do feel really like there's possibly some life in them, but I don't even know if I know anymore. And to bring them to Charlie and Sky and discover, I don't know, how much it means to play music together with other people again, and that the songs really need to live in that space of togetherness. That's where I found out that they had a heartbeat. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they feel differently about the songs that they wrote, but for the record, but certainly that was true for me.
Now, Sky's really earthy, wonderful singing is on this very affecting track, Everyone's Dying.
Oh, yeah.
And you have that a cappella opening. Was that song his, or did you guys co-write that?
That song was Sky's. And I had sung that with him. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, Sky and I go way back. Mm-hmm. He was part of an early trio that I led, and I've, you know, sung back up in his bands over time, and just is really a dear friend and collaborator, incredible musician. Everyone is Dying had a brief life in a band that maybe played a couple gigs. Sky was sort of working out some new music. Came to a screeching halt, I think, in February 2020 or something like that. But so I had seen that song go through some iterations of lyric, and I think there's maybe a verse in that song that is like somewhat inspired by Sky's observing me grieving my dad's death, and so it's not a co-write, but in some way I like I really feel myself in that song, which is a very incredible experience. I don't know that I've had that much in my life. Incredible and rare. And yeah, I love that song. There's something beautiful about the sobriety and honesty of the lyric, yeah. And a certain amount of buoyancy that's part of the sort of musical expression of that. I mean, it's not a bouncy upbeat song, but it isn't a dirge either, and that feels just like true to the reality of that statement. Everyone is dying. Everyone is vividly alive, and we're all going the same place.
Yeah. This is an excerpt from Everyone is Dying from Butylina with Eureka Shoes.
Everyone I love loves someone who is dying, and everyone I love is dying too. If you stay long enough, you have to watch them go. If you go too soon, oh, how they miss you. Angie's so sad about her dad, it's exquisite. Tears come on like thunderstorms of pain. And Rosa can't stop.
Well, if we could talk, I was curious about your musical education. You attended the New School?
I did, yeah.
Was that for jazz?
Yeah, I was in the jazz vocal performance program there. I didn't graduate from high school. I had a kind of wacky road. I went to Smith College for a year, which is a women's college in Massachusetts, and had a lot of good experiences there, but realized I really wanted to be immersed in a music school and in a musical culture. I mean, it felt important to me to be in a city. So I moved back home with my parents in New Jersey and commuted to the New School and joined the jazz program there, which, you know, if you can imagine, like, a certain amount of whiplash being at a women's college for a year and then coming to this jazz program, which was mostly men at that time, and being, you know, sometimes the only femme person in a lot of my classes. But that was really, it was a really good move for me and really helpful. And at some point I joined the double degree program that they have there with the undergrad liberal arts college. So I was kind of like, whoa, wait, too much music. I want to read books again, too. So I got a little bit of all of that. One thing that's really beautiful about the program at the New School at that time was that even though I was a jazz vocal performance major and really got a good grounding in, like, the American Songbook and a lot of just, like, important skills about theory and harmony, ear training, there was a lot of space for me to design my own path. And so at that time, I was really trying to learn a lot of Brazilian music. I was studying with some Brazilian musicians in town. I took a bunch of lessons with a fabulous singer who's no longer with us, Alexandra Montano, who had been part of Philip Glass's ensemble and, you know, was really interested in the voice as an instrument. And I wasn't doing so much songwriting back then, or I should say that a lot of the writing I was doing, writing of songs, was like really for myself, like journaling in some way. And I was not a proficient guitar player or pianist. I mean, I could invent some things for myself to play at that time, but a lot of the writing that I was doing, like, for the public, as it were, was, you know, just studies. I mean, like, trying to learn how to arrange something for a saxophone quartet, or what would it be like to write, you know, a soli section for this song. I mean, I was doing some of my own writing, and it was a very different aesthetic and different kind of lyrical approach, I think, than what I've grown into now. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, maybe we could jump back to Eureka Shoes, the barn hymn, the final tune on that.
That is amazing, but that I'm glad that she wanted to talk about that song. Let me think back. So I wrote that song while we were at Looking Glass Arts. Let me see if I can paint a little picture of this place. I mean, it's in an incredibly rural part of upstate New York. There's a house where everybody who's in residence has a bedroom and hot meals coming, and snacks and little wine in the evening. But then across this little country road is a big barn, and we recorded this record in the barn. I mean, you can hear, you know, the birds roosting in the rafters and the crickets at night and the birds chirping outside in the day. In the quieter moments on the record, they're just like coming in through the slats, you know, which we really welcomed. Rashawn Carter, who is playing bass on this album, was also the house engineer at Looking Glass Arts, and he was spending the whole summer and early fall up there. And one of the evenings when we were talking at dinner, he was expressing his appreciation for the healing qualities of that place. And the way I remember our conversation, it was just like, this is a place to repair and reset, coming from, you know, the city environment. And so, I don't know, just one morning, this melody kind of surfaced for me, and I, while everybody was like finishing lunch, I took myself across the street and sat in that space and teased out this really simple little hymn that we ended up recording that night. And what was so beautiful about it too is just getting to teach this song that was so fresh to me, to the people that we were, you know, to the band, but also to Marika, our host, who also plays cello on the album, and Willa, who was working there as well, a close partner with Marika on this project. And then also Kyle Sanna, who happened to be traveling through, incredible, like, guitar player, treasure, who contributed to that too. So it felt like it was like a real community gathering that evening when we recorded it. Yeah. And since then, I think I sent Marika a copy of the lyrics and a little like lead sheet for the song so that, you know, she could have it. Because, I mean, there is really no way to compensate these people and places who allow us to have time and space to create and sink into the music. And so it just felt like, here's a tangible object representing this piece of music that represents something approximating the gratitude that I have for that time and space.
Beautiful. Thanks, Jean.
Oh, yeah.
You're about to hear Barn Hymn from Butalina with Eureka Shoes.
May this be a sacred place. May it be a home for restless sound. May this be a peaceful place. A place to lay our every soul. The struggles of this world. Open up and let the music in.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was curious. You have this 2014 album, The End of the World Show, which I think reflects some of the early touring you were doing, including Brazil. Do you want to talk to any of those experiences?
Yeah, gosh. Okay, let's think back. That record is incredible. I mean, like, I say incredible, like, I cannot believe that that album came together. It just really represents a special moment of my life where a group of nine of us were playing music together pretty regularly in my home. Like, I don't even understand how we all fit. And, you know, I mean, we're talking like drummer, percussionist, vibraphone, you know, rhythm section. I mean, it was just a whole thing. And playing my music, and just, I'm so indebted to like the loyalty of those folks in that group and trust, the trust that they gave me. There were a number of us in that band who had connections to various forms of Brazilian music and Afro-Peruvian music styles, among other sort of like Latin American strands. And though many of us were from the United States, not everybody in that group. And so there was a real interest in these songs that I was writing, which were, most of them are in English, some of them are a little bit in Spanish or Portuguese, but we're drawing on a lot of like rhythms from those parts of the world. I love that New York City is full of people from all over the place. I mean, I've done a lot of traveling compared to most people, but also, I mean, I went to Brazil one time for a month, and spent a lot of time immersed in like the various music scenes in Rio, and then also in Recife, which is in the Northeast, learning about maracatu music and forró, but I guess I can say that like the people who got me interested in that in the first place and the communities where I was able to find that again were mostly in New York City, which is really amazing and special. So that album took shape when we all, nine of us, spent the better part of a week in at a residential recording studio upstate and recorded most of it live. I mean, it's amazing that we were able to do it like the way that we did. But people's hearts were really in it, and we really knew that music so well, and some very just incredible collaborative things came out of that project. I wonder if I could ever do something like that again. It was really, really special.
Hi, just a quick break from the episode. You may also be interested in these episodes, which I've linked directly in the show notes. Kavisha Metzela, Kiara Conway, Renee Yoxon, Sophie Lukacs, Shakura Saida, Diane Nalini, and Megan Jerome, among so many. It's a joy to be able to bring these meaningful conversations to you, but this project cost me quite a bit of money and lots of time. Please support this series, either through my merchandise store or on my Ko-fi page. You'll find the links in the show notes. For the merch, it features a unique design by artist Steffi Kelly, and everything is printed on demand. On my Ko-fi page, you can buy me one coffee or every month. You'll also find the links to sign up for my newsletter, where you'll get access to exclusive information about upcoming guests. Now back to Jean Rowe.
And did you also travel to the Republic of Georgia?
I did, yeah. I was there twice. I had a partner for a long stretch of time, Ilusha Tsinadze, who's also a brilliant musician, guitar player, from the Republic of Georgia.
Okay.
We met in New Jersey. He came when he was a young person with his family. I'll just say briefly, like, his musical journey is really incredible, but part of it involves reconnecting with his Georgian culture and learning a lot of the traditional music forms there, and kind of allowing them to meld with his backgrounds in improvised music and American music traditions. And we had the opportunity to bring some of that music back to Tbilisi in the like 2010 and 2011, something around there. Yeah. And I mean, if you can imagine, the Georgian public was really glad to receive one of their own, like from the diaspora, who was really getting, you know, deeply back in touch with the culture that, you know, they could have easily left behind.
Mm-hmm. They have quite a rich vocal culture, right? The a cappella.
Yes, and I think that that's a little bit better known. I mean, to the extent that people are familiar with Georgian music, it is really rich and really special, and there's a lot of kind of realms of the vocal music, varying by region and sort of the secular versus deep liturgical music from the Christian, like the Orthodox Georgian Church. One of the things that Ilyusha was getting really interested in is this maybe lesser known instrumental traditions and the folklore traditions, singing traditions that are, you know, instrumental accompaniment for like maybe a solo singer or smaller group, as opposed to these like a cappella vocal things that are quite striking.
Okay.
Yeah.
If we could jump over to your coaching of other songwriters, I was curious if you'd be willing to share a bit of your creative practice map and some of your ways of generating.
Oh, yeah. So, let's see. I teach songwriting to undergraduates at the New School right now. I also work in a program with Carnegie Hall called Musical Connections that happens at Sing Sing, which is a maximum security men's prison up in Ossining, New York. And then periodically I have private students and also run some workshops and all the info about that is on my website if any listeners are interested. I didn't think that would be something I would enjoy, teaching songwriting, but actually also during the pandemic, someone who is on my email list misread something that I had written in one of my newsletters and said, like, wait a second, how did I not know about the songwriting workshop? And I wrote back, what songwriting workshop? And we started this dialogue that where this person had really like imagined the outlines of something that I could lead. And I decided to give it a shot, thinking like, maybe I won't like this, but there was so much interest. And I enjoyed it so much. It made me realize how much I really love hearing the early embryonic forms of songs. There's something very exciting about even other people's creative process. So that's just a little bit of background. One of the gifts of starting to teach songwriting was that it's made me think about, like, how do I think about songwriting and how have I learned how to do this? I never took a songwriting class, you know. I've been a student through observation and trial and error and sort of learning what's in my own toolbox. I created a tool called the Creative Practice Map in 2020 for the people in the workshop at Musical Connections at Sing Sing who had been accustomed to every Saturday getting together, playing music, having access to their instruments in the music room. And now, because of the pandemic, we're not allowed to leave their cells or their dwellings. And I was just trying to picture that and think about how isolating that could be and what could I offer that could be a little bridge for folks to continue being in music and, or at least some kind of creative space during this very difficult moment, I'm sure. And so it was really fun to develop this, and I collaborated a little bit with some folks I knew who are formerly incarcerated to help me kind of like imagine the way this could be received. But the premise of this tool, it's just a PDF. I mean, you can find it on my website if you're interested. And I've been updating it over time too. But the premise of it is that we learn how to write songs by writing songs. And this is incredibly vexing to so many people who want me to give them a step-by-step guide to songwriting. But I really resist that because I think that between listening to great songs, like songs that we love, and thinking about what are the parts of them that make it work. And I think this is where a teacher can be really helpful to help draw your curiosity or your attention to certain elements within a song that you love. But then using that, building that awareness simultaneously with exploring and experimenting. And so the invitation in the creative practice map is spend 30 minutes in your day just making something. It doesn't really matter how you start. It's important to dedicate at least 30 minutes because I find at some point, even if things are really kind of rough and not just don't feel like they're going anywhere, if I spend time with something, there will be a revelation that comes. And then there's a series of the idea is like to just encourage people, like the way that you practice scales or the way that you practice long tones or whatever it is, like that's what a writing practice is too. It looks really different. There's not a method book. But here are some ideas for how you can start to write. And so there's just a list in no particular order, and certainly not an exhaustive list of ways in. Some of them have to do with melodic ideas. Some of them have to do with just like lifting chord changes from a song that you like and seeing how to change other parameters about them to inspire something new. Some of them are lyrical prompts. In the packet that I made, there's some reproductions of photographs and artwork and some questions to spark people's curiosity for writing or improvising in response to those. Also some poetry that, you know, could be set to music, but also could be the springboard for other lyrical ideas. But I think being generative is instructive in itself. We start to learn what tools we readily have access to, which are so different for each of us. The things that come naturally to me might feel really foreign to someone else and vice versa. And why is it important to do? I think it's really important to do this because we learn about ourselves through the act of creation, and we discover what we have to give to other people. Which is so important and valuable. Like, why else are we here on this planet if not to contribute in some way to reflecting the world back at itself? I think it's something humans really can do. And it's amazing what happens when we give ourselves the time to explore that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Are there particular songs or experiences working with the incarcerated people that really stayed with you?
Oh yeah, that work is some of the most inspiring that I've done. It's really challenging just because of the parameters of the space and the difficulty communicating between classes, and just, you know, there's a lot of like logistical things that you can imagine that would make it challenging. I guess every time I'm there, I'm struck by the dedication of all of our participants, how hard people really work, sometimes with, always with suboptimal conditions for that work. And how, I mean, I don't want to overstate the fact of their incarceration to these people's identities. I think different people really consider that differently. But I have had really profound experiences watching people come to terms with what they've done, you know, people are there for all different kinds of reasons, and some people for no reason at all. But for those who've, like, done some real harm, and many of whom have also had harm done to them, the songwriting space can be a really important place to process that and acknowledge that and share it in a way that we can be contained and where we can witness them, which I think is really important. I think also just the program is so great because it exposes folks to lots of different kinds of music. There are guest artists who have come in, like Arturo Farrell or Common, you know, in recent years to work with folks, and just really, that's had a huge impact on the participants in our program and other people who are living at Sing Sing. I guess I can share, like, one recent thing that happened was someone who's incarcerated there wrote a song for his daughter, who is young but starting to process the fact that he's inside. And he had a lot of feelings of guilt about not being there for her, and wrote a really beautiful song expressing that and, like, laying out the scene. But one of the things that came up as we were working on that, you know, he brought it to me and we were workshopping some things about it. And, you know, we talked about the chord changes and the melody and the form. And then there's always this little piece that I find so powerful for anybody who's writing song, which is like, okay, you've blurted this out, but, like, now what's really at the heart of this? Now that you're looking at all these feelings you have, what's really at the heart of this? At the heart of this is, like, you are there for your daughter. You're not there the way you wanted to be. You have regrets about that. You're trying to make it right. But what's really true is that you are showing up. So is there a way that you can give yourself some love for that in the context of this song, you know, while acknowledging the things that you've screwed up? And, you know, I think that makes the song better because it's more true. It's more, like, true in the sense of not factual true, but, like, the truth of this piece of art. And we feel that as listeners. But also, I think I've had the experience myself, and I don't know about others, but where writing a song has really changed me. Like, I want that from my experience, and I want that for other people. So I don't know what will come of this for this person, but I think really refining those concepts and, like, emotional qualities of the music and lyrics is critical for the quality of the song and for what it can do for the writer.
Yeah, okay. And you also mentioned you're teaching at the new school where you had gone to school. So it must have changed in all that time, the institution.
Yeah, it has changed a lot. The thing I can say about that is there was not a songwriting class to speak of there when I was a student. And now there is. And I mean, I think it's okay to take credit for originating some of the structures around that. And there's a real desire for that program to continue to grow. And some of my students there are writing really great stuff and are really hard workers and are taking full advantage of the fact that this songwriting concentration is embedded within the jazz program. Mm-hmm. So there are lots of players there, other students who can contribute to their vision in really creative and interesting ways. And I always find that really fun to watch.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
Yeah.
I do a little teaching. I mostly play violin, but I find on the days when maybe my playing isn't feeling so good, I feel like as a teacher, at least I know I'm helping somebody. And I can sort things out of my own head a bit.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, and it's so cool to witness somebody doing, like, I don't know, it just reminds me, like, I had a student last week who just, like, really took on some suggestions I had made and really explored them deeply and then made some new choices about her song, which she then performed in the concert. And I just felt like, Well, that's great. Like, I can do that too. You know, it's such a reminder when you see your students doing something like kind of heroic like that, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So back to Eureka Shoes, there was one more song I wanted to touch on. This is one of your songs, I Wanna Be.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I love that song. And where the heck did that come from? I love how playful and sweet that song is. And so great. That was one of the first things I actually brought to Charlie and Skye. And they just like dug in with some just really lush fiddling that it doesn't sound anything like it, but I do remember having this distinct thought. I don't know if you've ever heard some of these like Scandinavian like fiddle music that's mm-hmm. just really like floating and flying and everybody's like playing together. It didn't sound like that, but it had that feeling to me that made me so happy. Yeah. I mean, I wrote that song for my partner. I haven't written a lot of love songs that are uncomplicated, but I was just really reflecting on how much it means to feel loved and how, like, for me, the effect of that is not just like this dyadic experience with the other person, but that it makes me feel good and makes me able to like live in the world and not give up and share with other people. And I, you know, that was the impetus for writing the song. It has come to feel important in other friendships and stuff that I've had too. I don't know. It's a thing I always find with my songs that like there's a reason I wrote it, but then as time goes by, just sort of other experiences feel like they can be encapsulated in the song. I can draw on them while I'm singing it. It's funny that when I first wrote that song, I sent it to a friend, songwriting mentor of mine who I often share work with when it's fresh. And he got back to me with some comments about it, you know, which is, it's always really helpful to have a sounding board like that. But then he went on to tell me like all the things that he thought were problematic about polyamory. And I was like, where are you getting this from, man? Like I mean, fine, this song can be about whatever you want it to be, but that's not what I'm trying to direct people's attention to here. So sometimes when we play it live, I introduce it like that because it is very funny to me.
Yeah. This is a clip of I Wanna Be from Eureka Shoes' album, Butylina.
On this old black dress, I wanna cut loose, I wanna cut loose, I wanna kick my shoes off and dance around. I was tied up in nights I couldn't see, live with you. Yes, I
yeah, I've talked to other songwriters on this series about, do you present the meaning of the song before? It's usually, I think, thought it's better to talk about it maybe afterwards so people can have their own experience of it.
Yeah. I don't know. I think different songs require different things. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I don't know. It's one of the really fun things about touring and playing night after night after night is like, you can kind of experiment with sort of like, mm-hmm. what happens, or what do I perceive happens for the audience when I set a song up one way or another. I don't know. Sometimes I find an introduction that's a little bit of a red herring can be cool. Like, yeah, telling a story that like misdirects and then maybe the song can land in a different way. I don't know. I do get very like geeky about the sort of theatricality of performance, not in the sense of like, I don't know, big like dance numbers and light shows, but sort of the fact that in performance, and especially songs with lyrics that are, you know, narrative or descriptive, not super abstract the way that my writing is, it can be so fun to think about, like, what's the spoken connected tissue, mm-hmm. connective tissue or unspoken that allows the listener to really experience these songs, you know, in a special way because they're happening in performance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you have any touring strategies for your, you know, your mental and physical health, being on the road a lot?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think sleep where you can. I try not to take red-eye flights anymore because they wreck me. I have a little apothecary that I take with me that's got some Chinese herbs and zinc lozenges and vitamin C and oregano oil, some things like that, that just, if I find myself in some backwater wasteland and I'm not feeling great, I know I at least have those things to tide me over. But yeah, and eating well is so hard to do on the road, but getting some fruits and vegetables at the grocery store and just stashing them away, really important. Loving that peanut butter jar. I think car touring is a little bit easier for those sorts of things. You can be a little more self-contained, but yeah, it's not easy. It's not for the faint of heart. Mm-hmm. I think I don't tour as much as some people do, and because I'm an independent artist and self-managed and all of that, there are definite drawbacks to that in terms of the amount of labor that I'm doing, but there's also a lot of discretion that I have about how I tour and how many dates I'm out and like what kind of insane drives I need to do. So I think I've learned to take care of myself by making good choices about, you know, what I can really do, what I can really sustain.
Yeah. Yeah. That's super interesting. Mm. And I've certainly talked to people where it was the opposite, where they're part of this whole machine and they have to go along with that.
Yeah. I mean, there's a part of me that really desires to know what that experience is like, and another part that recognizes that, yeah, I'm a control freak. Yeah. And there are some real benefits to being in charge of my destiny. Mm-hmm.
So if we could talk about your collaborations with Liam Robinson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Liam Robinson is my partner in life and in music. I mean, in life for maybe the last 10 years, and musical collaborator for, we've known each other for 20 years. Liam is a party to almost everything that I make. And I think the reverse is also true. We have a duo together called Robinson and Rowe.
And a new album, Into the Night?
Yes, Into the Night. Ooh, I love that record. Yeah, Liam is a pianist and accordion player, banjo player, songwriter, really gorgeous singer. Also grew up in a like an avocationally musical family, so we just share a lot of intuition around community singing. He's also the music director and vocal arranger for the Broadway show Hades Town, which is still running up here in New York and in various places around the globe at the moment. And so that keeps him busy. And he's also co-produced some of my records with me. He's writing some string arrangements for a new solo album that I'm working on right now. And is like the first listener for most songs that I have written. And a really, really careful and really good listener. So yeah, Robinson and Rowe, our duo, started out as a sort of song leading outfit. We were doing a lot of traditional music and leading group singing in various places, mm-hmm. busking in the subway. And then we started writing together or writing separately, like for the duo in this kind of Americana acoustic vein. And so we have a couple records out. Into the Night is the newest, and then also Hunger, which is a little more of a string band kind of sounding record. And yeah, it's so great working with Liam. I think there's something special about a duo configuration. It's like less responsibility than being a solo performer, a bigger palette of sound, but also not the kind of like bombastic unwieldiness of a bigger group. And so fun to perform on stage with him. And really interesting, I mean, Liam's background is in many backgrounds. I mean, jazz piano, folk singing, but also he went to college for composition at the Manhattan School of Music, and he brings a real sort of orchestrational ear to everything that he does. I mean, a lot of his other work life is collaborating with other artists on their projects in various sort of orchestrationally minded ways. So to bring that to a duo where like the elements that we're working with are very few, but the details can get pretty specific, it's just really fun having his sensibilities there. Mm-hmm. And I learn a lot. We learn a lot from each other, I think, through that duo process.
One of the songs on Into the Night, which I found that the lyrics were so powerful, Where I'm Coming From.
Oh, yeah. That's one of my tunes that I wrote with that duo in mind. Yeah, and we recorded that on the record with the great fiddler Duncan Wickle and bass player that we both collaborate with a lot, Chris Tordini. Yeah, I wrote that song at the Blue Mountain Center, also in upstate New York, also a great treasure of time and space. Well, I was thinking of a lot of things. I was thinking about Woody Guthrie and the way that Woody Guthrie, his body of work, among many other things, really managed to encapsulate moments of American history. Like, there are minor strikes that I know about because of Woody Guthrie's songs, and I don't know, that feels like a real treasure. So I was thinking about that and his writing style. And then I was thinking about, like, what is the quote-unquote white culture of the United States right now, and how did it come to be this way? I am the fruit of that lineage in some part. And so I try to tell this composite story of European immigration to the United States, this sort of like the tale that we sometimes like to tell about how we're a country of immigrants or something like that. But how those same people, some generations later, are bought into, you know, a really reactionary, xenophobic sensibility about the United States. And, like, how did that transformation happen from being an excluded underclass of laborers who are exploited and spit on, to gatekeepers, I guess. Anyway, it was really interesting to me, and so just sadly feels more and more relevant to the state of the world with each passing year. I really labored over the lyrics of that song for a long time, and and really felt like held up by Woody Guthrie's spirit and others like him who just really tried to tell the truth about who we are.
Mm-hmm. You're about to hear Where I'm Coming From with Robinson and Rowe from their album Into the Night. When you're writing, like you play guitar and mandolin, do you have an instrument in your hand when you're composing?
Most of the time, yeah. I'm not a person who like sits with a piece of paper and writes a bunch of lyrics first. I mean, sometimes, I don't know, sometimes there's something I'm toying with, but it comes from an act of improvisation. And actually, sometimes I sit at the piano too. I think better with the piano, and I'm a little more intuitive when I'm playing guitar or like another string instrument. Sometimes I have ideas while I'm riding my bike. Like it never, the words never come separate from the music for me. I mean, they get refined separately, but actually a lot of the songs that I wrote on for the End of the World show, my philosophy at that time was like, if I can't remember the lyrics, they weren't any good. And so I wasn't really writing things down until the song was pretty complete, which is like weird to me. I don't really do that anymore, but it was all kind of in my mind and in my hands and in my singing while I was writing a lot of those songs.
We've talked a lot about your writing, Jean, but I have to say your voice is so beautiful. I absolutely love your voice.
Oh, thank you.
I was wondering, when you were studying jazz as a student, was there pressure from anyone to kind of change the nature of your voice to fit that style more?
I didn't experience it as pressure, but I definitely heard desires from certain people that like that it didn't sound like that music, I guess, to them. But no, I think by and large, if anything, I got some really good guidance, you know, like my singing upbringing and my like intuitive way with singing was really like informed by like, you know, Appalachian singer, just a very specific kind of vocal placement and sound that still is what comes most naturally to me. And, is an amazing and beautiful sound that I love. And there was, I also got a lot of encouragement and guidance about how to expand timbrally what was possible and, you know, just things about like smoothing out my break and expanding my range and having sort of equal power and balance through all my registers. And, you know, and as I get older, like my voice continues to change, and it's just so interesting feeling how those different lessons are like in my awareness and body, or not, you know, the ways that I want to keep getting some refreshers about the voice and staying interested in the voice mm-hmm. as an instrument. I think that's another thing too, as I became more interested in playing guitar and really I've never really taken guitar lessons. I've had people show me some things here and there, but I really like so many things, I really want to figure things out myself. And similarly with songwriting, just really immersing myself in that craft and practice. I noticed, you know, a couple years ago, like, oh, I'm not as interested in the voice as an instrument anymore. And I want to relocate that curiosity again. And so that's been, a piece of my like practice and awareness more recently, is like what's exciting and interesting about my voice, about the voice mm-hmm. as an instrument.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A couple of months ago, I spoke with, for the series, the opera singer Omo Bello. Oh. And we talked about that whole idea of the voice. And she said, it's very much separate from you. It's the instrument. And as a violinist, I find that very interesting.
Mm. Wait, so because the violin is physically separate from...
It is. I mean, you feel super connected to your instrument, but it's not me. But she said it's that way for her as a singer, that the voice is, you know, it's not her, it's the voice.
Yeah, that's so interesting. See, these are the kinds of sort of like high-level philosophical questions and conversations I want to have with other people who are really thinking about the voice or their voice. I mean, I guess depending on who they are. It's interesting because I think for a lot of people listening to music, right, the first things they hear are the vocal quality of the singer, if there's a singer, and the like production elements, like, oh, like I love how intense the drums feel, or that like guitar solo. I notice that so much with talking about music with my students, for example. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course, I can appreciate a beautiful voice, and sometimes it's hard to take in music when, whatever, I don't know, someone's intonation is so wild in an unpleasing way. But besides that, I think that is not my first focal point. It's the, like, sort of vocal acrobatics of a singer. And maybe more the emotion of it, which is so hard to put your finger on. But when it's there, it's there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Although that's subjective too, right?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Totally. Yeah. Like all of this stuff, I think it's so important. Well, to not hurt yourself with your, you know, vocal technique or your whatever instrument you're playing.
Mm-hmm.
Longevity, I think, is important. But beyond that, it's like people are going to like what they're going to like and not like what they're not going to like. And at the end of the day, you need to be able to please yourself and, like, trust your own taste, because that's what matters. So many of my songwriting students want me to, like, tell them what to do. And I can suggest avenues for their own curiosity and exploration, but ultimately I don't know what they are trying to do, so we can experiment together, but you always have to make that decision based on what you care about and love, you know.
Yeah, so Jean, to close this out, I thought it might be a fun to reflect on other creative outlets you have or that you'd be curious about exploring for yourself.
Yeah, you're just thinking artistically outside of, like, sound.
Yeah.
Or song. Oh my God, don't get me started. Okay, well, in a hobbyist way, a friend of mine about a couple years ago taught me how to do, like, linoleum cut prints. Mm-hmm. And that's been really fun for me. And I've made some things that I sell at shows, and I want to keep doing that. I have been doing a lot of writing of text in prose poetry form. I keep telling people I'm writing a book, but I'm not really sure what it's going to be. But that's a big part of my life, kind of piggybacking off of some concepts I was exploring in a song called Animal, and just extrapolating, I don't know, doing a lot of horticultural research and writing. And then lastly, I mean, I think I was alluding to, like, my interest in the theatricality part of performing. I have been working on a piece that's a performance memoir about my dad. It's very music oriented, but there's a lot of text and, you know, spoken performed stuff and sound collage. And so I've really been thinking about the full breadth of, like, theater and what movement and visual information can convey together with sound. I mean, this is not new. That's what opera is, but and musical theater certainly, and so many other kinds of performance art, Laurie Anderson's work and whatnot. It's different. It's a new territory for me and something I'm really curious about. And that piece is called 74 Corridor.
And so that's something you're working on, or it's...
Yeah, it's something I'm working on. I've done a couple performances of iterations of it, and I'm continuing to write into that and look for collaboration from folks who are not musicians, which is, wow, what a world of trust and, what a leap of faith.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Well, thanks so much for this today. It's been really great to talk to you.
Yeah, right back at you, Leah. Thank you so much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please share this with your friends and check out episodes you may have missed at leahroseman.com. If you could buy me a coffee to support this series, that would be wonderful. Or you can browse the collection of merch with a very cool, unique, and expressive design from artist Steffi Kelly, with notebooks, mugs, shirts, phone cases, and more. I'm an independent podcaster, and I really do need the help of my listeners. All the links are in the show notes. Have a wonderful week.